more. Maybe it's not nice. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We come. Grass make dab.
Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. I tell you what, a lot is going on. We've had a toppling of a president in Egypt, President Morsi. There's still a lot of trouble over there with the Muslim Brotherhood, and they're having fits over there now. So it's going to be interesting to see how that works out. Our first hour, Charlotte is off tonight. She did help me do research on the Egyptian plantation, and you can read that white paper at thesecrettruth.com. We're broadcasting live on 90.1 FM in Austin, Texas. You can go into our website and pick up those files after the broadcast, or you can listen live on 90.1 if you're in the Austin area. We're going to also be putting up some files of an encore that we might think that you might like also. And I think that's going to work out pretty good. The encore, surprisingly enough, has been very popular. And we've been getting very, very good response on our encore productions. So anyway, our first hour, let me just reiterate a little bit with a little synopsis for those that missed the first hour tonight. Here live in Austin, Texas. Our phones are closed for the night, so we're just going to be lecturing tonight and covering this. We really don't have time to take phone calls tonight, but we'll work that in a few weeks. The situation in Egypt is very tense tonight. The Muslim Brotherhood lost their president. The military junta over there suspended him and suspended the Constitution. So tonight is very tenuous over there in Egypt, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen. Let me go back in a little time in time here with a little history of what's been going on in the past 50 years plus, and tell you what really happened in Egypt, and maybe that'll give us some perspective about what's going on today there. King Farouk the First of Egypt was a ruler up until 1952 in Egypt. They had a very big agricultural subsistence type of economy. The farmers over there had to pay 75% of their crop to the landowners. The individuals owned there were 65% of the land in Europe was owned by 0.5% of Egyptians, and they owned over one third of all the fertile land. This small 0.5% of Egyptians, and these major owners had almost autocratic control over the land they owned and charged high rents. And like I said, they charged 75%. To make a long story short, we had a revolt in 1952. There was a revolt in Egypt. Nasser, the strong man, came in from the free officer movement, and then he instituted immediately some land reforms It took a little while to get those done. But anyway, he began to redistribute land to individual farmers. And this helped for a long time. And then also, he did nationalize certain industries and businesses in Egypt. So he began to start a socialist type of economy in Egypt at that time. And really, that's one of the problems that's wrong with Egypt today. But over a long period of time, the military began to gain a greater power and ownership over formerly state-owned businesses, of which they began to take over themselves. In 1979, it really was accelerated when Egypt struck a peace treaty with the Israelis. They had all these troops, all these soldiers, and they looked around for something to do, and they began to put them to work in industry. So they became a major manufacturer of many items. Now, if you go into thesecrettruth.com and scroll down and just read that article, you need to read that article and just see what you think about it. Because that article will tell you a lot of the dynamics here. A bunch of people, just protesters and out in the streets and Tahrir Square and all that, that doesn't mean much unless you have some perspectives, historical perspective about why they're there, who they are, and the different factions and power groups that exist today. The Egyptian army became very powerful and a great owner of a good portion of the Egyptian economy. Some would say from a low from 20% to 40%. Most scholars that know and economists that look at this and study this say between 35 to 40%, which is a tremendous amount of any economy to own and dominate. So this is where what we're looking at today. We're looking at a military, a very large military, a very well-equipped military, and putting down any civil disturbance because they have a monopoly of force. And also, they own a great deal of the economy. So we're not going to see a great reform movement ever succeeding in Egypt as long as the military owns what they do. And also, in addition, they have a secret budget that they will not provide to the public at large. So nobody knows everything they own, all the income that they have, or any subsidies they may be receiving from the government. They're on the budget payroll too, in addition to receiving military aid directly from the United States, usually over $1 billion plus. And then other aid also we've been giving them. So right now, we're looking at a situation to where they've dismissed President Morsi. They've suspended the Constitution, provisionally is the way they termed it. And we're going to see a new president appointed, an interim president, and Adli Mansour, he was formerly the chief executive of the Supreme Court of Egypt for 2 days, and then all of a sudden he's appointed by the army here, by the armed forces of Egypt, to be the new interim president. We've got to look at that. Read the article. Come into thesecrettruth.com. Read the article if you missed the first hour. Read it anyway and see what there's a lot of click-offs in there. There's one click-off in there that'll tell you all a much of the products that they're manufacturing. They manufacture high-speed boats, 50-mile-an-hour speedboats. That army's doing this. But anyway, go in there and check that out. Last night was, a couple of nights ago, was July 4th. And I happened to see July 4th, what was it called, on the Washington 4th, or however they labeled that. And it was in Washington, D.C., and it was quite something. And I began to see some of the actors and actresses that were celebrating the 4th, a Capitol 4th, America's Independence Day celebration. Okay, let me tick off a few of the people. Tom Bergeron was the Emmy-winning television personality. He was the host. Oh, Barry Manilow. He did a lot of singing, four or five songs or more. And he was a big hit. He was last time he was there. So he's very popular. There's a little lady that sang the national anthem at the beginning. And her name, my gosh, she is a killer. And a banjo, Jackie a banjo. And Jackie a banjo won one of the American whatever it was one year. And that's where I first saw her. She sang operatic music, you know, very serious music. Well, she's crossing over, trying to cross over, and trying to, they're trying to get her into a crossover, Jackie a banjo, crossover type of career now. Megan Hilty, Broadway and television star, Smash, Motown, they had a Motown extravaganza. John Williams conducted the music from the blockbuster Lincoln. The National Symphony Orchestra played and so forth. Now, one of the things that really was disconcerting to me, and it always is because I make a point to look at the Capitol. The U.S. Capitol has several flags on there over it. One of those flags is the POW flag. And I don't like what I see. Now, you might ask me, well, George Butler, the hell are you saying? Well, here's what I'm saying. There were POWs left behind in Vietnam that this Congress and none of the previous Congresses that back to the peace treaty that we struck with the North Vietnamese has ever brought home. Now, what are they doing putting a POW flag up there? I'll tell you what they're doing. They're making the public at large think that they really care about the POWs and the Vietnam veterans, the prisoners of war and all this. And they haven't lifted their little finger in helping to bring the remaining remnants home. And we think that there's still several dozen in a secret prison in Vietnam. But this Congress has virtually done nothing to bring those people home. So that's why I'm saying I don't like that flag up there, because they're a bunch of hypocrites. They put this POW flag up there to make all the American public think they really care about the POWs, and they didn't lift a finger to bring the... There were several hundred at one time. The North Vietnamese refused to release several hundred at the end of the war, and we bargained about $3 billion to have all of the prisoners released. But according to Bill Hinden, who wrote a book, An Enormous Crime, no Congress since the end of the Vietnam War ever appropriated that money so we could bring all the POWs home. And as a result, Congress sticks a flag up there making everybody think that they're great. Well, they're not great. Congress has fallen. They're worthless. They're out there for the money. They're hustling everybody. That's what they're about. If they really knew what was going on, they wouldn't put the flag up there and be hypocrites about it. Well, anyway, I looked back there, and they had these television shots, and it was one of the best productions I've ever seen of a fourth, you know, celebration. And then they'd go back and they'd show the Capitol building. It was still light. The sun was going down. And see that flag up there, you know. Anyway, that harps me. I was in the Army during the Vietnam era. I did not go to Vietnam, but I lost friends there. And I'm mad as hell about it because we didn't bring our prisoners of war home like we should have. And I worked on this before with some really fine gentlemen. Bill Hinden, who wrote this book, An Enormous Crime, we reran on one of our Encore productions. We did that. And you know what? That Encore production, as old as it was, it went back to 2010, has generated more traffic onto our site than any program, whether it's live tonight, like tonight, or any other live program we've done ever. That brought people in because they still care about those POWs. And I believe we had the second hour, we did two full hours, Charlotte and I did, with Bill Hinden. And the first hour was just alone with Bill Hendon. In the second hour, I brought two of the founding members of Rolling Thunder, that motorcycle group, that veterans motorcycle group in, and to reminisce and things like that. And my gosh, I think it went throughout the Rolling Thunder, and they said, go in there and listen to that. And those two men have passed away now. They're gone. And I forget their names off the top of my head. But just to tell you, there are people that still care about our POWs and our veterans. And it certainly isn't the U.S. Congress. John Kerry and John McCain both had a chance in 1972 to bring the remaining veterans home, the POWs home, and they did not do it. They intentionally lied and covered up the fact that there were still remaining veterans. Kissinger was right in the middle of the whole shooting match and the dirty mess, and Richard Armitage was there also. Now he's running around as some great chairman of the American Turkish Committee or something, and he also helped cover this thing up. He was working with the CIA in Vietnam with the dope deals out there, in the Golden Triangle. That's what he was doing. Now he's a big shot in our government. That's what they do. They reward all these people that made them millions and put them up there, up high, and give them big titles and everything. Well, that guy's fact is worthless. But anyway, I'm sort of mad tonight about this because, on the 4th, when I saw that and I saw that flag, it made me mad as hell. By God, they don't really care about our vets and our POWs. And it shows obvious what they're doing. It's obvious that they don't care. But anyway, so much for that. Getting back to Jackie Evanjo, she is really a beautiful little lady. She's growing up now. I saw her when she was much younger, and she has a tremendous voice, and I wish her all the luck. Of all the people that perform, she's my favorite, and she's quite a lady. She has a really nice family and mom, and I wish her the greatest luck in the world for the future to a success, and she really deserves it, too. We had the fallen firefighters out in Prescott, Arizona, 19. There was a 20th man that was a lookout that did escape. I've talked to a personal friend of mine, Mike, and he's actually worked right out of that very center there at Prescott and other centers, firefighting centers, when he was a young man. And he said that those wind changes can occur just in a matter of 30 or 40, 50 minutes, an hour. And if you get caught on the wrong side of the wind, you can really, really suffer. And that's what happened to these 19 young men. And we certainly, sympathize with their families, for their losses of those fine young men that went out there to do a hard job and a dirty job and came up with the loss of their lives. But anyway, we want to extend the greatest condolences to those families out there in Prescott, Arizona, and wherever their families are all over the country. So we're still experiencing some clashes. Some clashes had occurred on Friday night in Egypt. We don't know. It's pretty... it's around 8 o'clock here in Austin now, so we're about 7 hour difference. So we're looking at about 3 or 4 in the morning, over about 3 o'clock in the morning over there right now, 3:35 in the morning. So we don't have any report now on this Saturday night what's going on, but on Friday they did have some clashes, and also there was an announcement on Friday from Venezuela about Snowden, and I believe that they're going to be providing him. Venezuelan's president Nicolas Maduro, he talked to the media on Friday, and he said that he would offer sanctuary and asylum to Edward Snowden. Now, this is what I have to say. I was on George Riley's program a little over a week ago, be 2 weeks ago next Tuesday, and she asked me about Edward Snowden, and knowing that I was in the ASA, And I'll tell you, we'll talk about that a little bit too. I was in the Army Security Agency in Berlin, and West Berlin at that time in 1965. But we reported directly to the NSA, which was our immediate command structure. Our boss was the NSA. Recently, there's been in Der Spiegel magazine, there was a photo journalism about where we worked. We worked on top of what they call the Teufelsberg, the Devil's Mountain. And it was well over 300 feet tall of rubble that had been hauled out of the buildings there in Berlin during the war, at the end of the war. There was rubble everywhere. They destroyed a good portion of Berlin. We not only bombed it, but the Russians went in and with artillery and blew it to pieces. But anyway, they hauled out much of the rubble and piled it, some of it, out in the green forest and made a mountain out of it. It happened to be the highest artificial point in the whole area. Artificially built, that is. I think there was a hill over by Tempelhof that was the highest natural hill in the area there in Berlin. But as far as an artificially built point, observation point, the Teufelsberg was it. At that time, we were working inside of an inflatable dome, you know, these NORAD domes that had pressure inside. We were working inside, actually, the inflatable dome was up above us, and we were working one floor below it in a communications center there, building, communications site. We were intercepting all kinds of communications in the area, Russians and East Germans, and there might have been some Czech traffic, too, in there, so forth. But anyway, we had the observation. We had the highest point in the whole area there. Berlin itself is fairly in a fairly flat area. So going up 300-plus feet, and I think it's about 340 feet or so tall, will give you quite a bird's-eye view of the rest of the city. The city itself is about 25 miles in diameter east to west, north to south, so it encompasses a large area. It's not one city. There's a bunch of cities that it makes up, see? And so that's basically the way it's made up. And the little towns make up all the east and the west. We were only in the west at the time. And so that's basically where we worked. Anyway, getting back to this Edward Snowden, I told George Riley the other morning that on the third hour, I told her, she asked me, well, George, here's what I think. As long as none of the information would hurt any of our fighting men on the ground, that's okay with me. I said, on the other side, if the information did expose a system of eavesdropping and wiretapping that in many people's minds and opinions is illegal, intrusive, and should not exist, period, then I would consider Edward Snowden to be doing a very, very good service for the country. And I think it's going to work out something like that. Nothing is perfect, so there might be information that could harm some people here or there, but we might be able to come out with more exposure of what they're doing illegally on this wiretapping and interception than on the other side of hurting our fighting men. But I hope so. I hope the expose that's coming out will cause the NSA and this government to retrench and rethink these particular programs and hopefully curb the excesses that we see in these programs. I'm not, confident that that's going to happen because we got the Bloomdale thing out there. Was it called Bluffdale interception site where they can store forever? They can store things forever out there. So I'm not optimistic that we're going to make any headway in this interception business and so forth. But anyway, that's to be dealt with in the future. We'll have to just do what we can and do that. There were some information here that sounded like it was released on Friday. Okay, the jobs report was released Friday. And it says the Labor Department reported that the economy gained 195,000 jobs in June, which beat economists' expectations. The department also reported that the economy gained 70,000 more jobs in April and May than it originally estimated. Boy, this is sounding pretty good, isn't it? Huh? We haven't gotten down to the punchline yet, okay? Then it goes on to say the report, however, when you see the word however, or but, or and, if only, maybe, if so, they said it, some say this, you know, I mean, anyway, let's get back to this. The report, however, also provides clear evidence that the nation is splitting into two. Oh, splitting into two. Yeah, we know that. Left and right, Democrats, Republicans. Okay, it goes on to say that only 47% of Americans have a full-time job, and those who don't are finding it increasingly out of reach. So what they did, they went to these part-time deals where they don't have to give you full benefits. And then with the Obamacare, that's another deal that made people go to 30%, 30-hour weeks versus 40-hour weeks. So it's becoming much of a mess. It said here, of the 144 million Americans employed last month, only 116 million were working full-time. So that's not too good. Anyways, so much for the working man in America commentary, huh? Okay, we've got Venezuela. Let's get back to the NSA and Venezuela offering Edward Snowden asylum. And that's official. I mean, I don't have any latest reply here. He's still in this transition area, transitory area in Moscow, evidently. But anyway, we're going to get some more information on that. Maybe we'll have some before the program is over tonight, and we can fill you in. We're back live, and we're going to be having current programs now, but also we're going to be doing some things that are going to be interesting. Not only will you be able to pick us up live on air broadcast at 90.1 FM in the Austin, greater Austin metro area, but you'll be able to come in and click on some of our encore presentations that we've done also. Also, we're gonna do some streaming out here on Shoutcast and get this thing out there to where you can actually come in and listen to the program as it's being broadcast here live from our Austin studios. When we say money, what do we mean by money? When we say credit, is it credits or is it really money? Okay? Well, a number of years ago, Bob Chapman and I were speaking about money, banking, and things like this. And we were trying to get a handle on what was really going on. And in fact, Bob Chapman was part of the ASA, Army Security Agency, in Germany. He preceded me by about 10 years in Kassel. He was in Kassel, Deutschland, Germany. And my first year in Germany, I was in a Herzo base, with Herzogenaurach, which was the corporate office of Adidas Shoes. But then I was transferred in my second year to work to West Berlin, worked on top of the Teufelsberg, the Devil's Mountain. Anyway, we were talking, and it was not the very first interview that I had with him. Might have been the second. And I told him about this theory that I had money and banking. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, basically, I started off in doing a theory. I wrote a theory called time dynamism back in 1988, and I presented the paper, you could say to a I actually wrote a small little book, about 35-page book, and put it out there in the card catalog at UT, University of Texas at Austin. Anyway, I got up there and I did this video, a presentation, a 45-minute speech on my space-time theory at the time, you know. And so what I've done is if you go into greencity.com, you'll see right at the top there, you'll see what I came up with, okay? And it's called, money physics or money sorcery. And it's about the way I believe it, in other words, years ago, we were having Patriot meetings here in Austin in the 90s. Throughout, from 90 on to about 96, 97, 1996, 1997. And we had these Patriot meetings, and everybody was saying, everybody knew back then money's created out of thin air and this and that. But it's actually credit, because the banks have a monopoly through the Federal Reserve to create these loans that they can put on a set of books, and then, you know, it sort of works like this. I don't know. My regular listeners maybe have heard this before, but it bears repeating. You're a small businessman and you need $5,000 for inventory. You go into your banker and he says, yeah, your credit looks good and you've got more than enough collateral. So here he fills out a credit memo and he gives you the credit memo and says, go on over to the teller and they'll put that in the account for you, credit to your account. So where's the money come from? There wasn't any money. It was an entry on a set of books the bank had. Now you can go over and go to back to your business and write a check and give it to someone, and then they'll take that and debit off of that credit they have at your bank. But that's coming from another set of books on another bank. So that's how it works. That's credit, see. So I begin, you know, they kept saying at these meetings, money is created from out of thin air, and we're actually credit we're talking about. Credit is created from out of thin air, they kept saying over and over. I went home one night and I came back and I said, hey, I've got an answer. It's not thin air. And they said, what is it then? I said, the credit's the idea, basically, is what we're talking about. It has been created from out of the space-time continuum. So what's happened is that this is a sorcery type of operation that we're dealing with here. And that's why it's so insidious. It's got occult involvement and leanings and sorcery and magic involved in the money system. And that's why they conjured up the idea of creating a system where they could create these credits from out of nowhere. And it didn't cost them anything, and then charge you interest. And then eventually they can put those credits and get a real physical item like a car, and then repo your car and have a real physical item for credits that they created on a set of books. So what I basically did was, if you go into greencity.com, and at the top, I think it says money sorcery. It's a PDF or a doc file. Go download that and look at it. And basically, it's saying that that money physics manifests in the universe with two arguments. Okay, in my space-time theory it's called time dynamism. I backed into that through perspective. I begin to see that the inverse squared relationship, I hope this doesn't get too technical, it's real simple. And you can go check it out and replay the file later if you'd like. We'll put it up so where you can get this file in a matter of an hour or two. But anyway, the space-time continuum is being dominated by an idea, And the idea basically is that we're going to have a fractional banking system and write checks among all the deposit holders, see? And then we can, then over and above what we actually have, we'll create more credit than actual reserves that we can have, because not everyone will call for their cash all at one time. See? Cash that actually have a physical specie, say, to give you, see? Where most of the time they just have these things on a set of books, see? So, in my time dynamism theory and book, I begin to see the universe in a very simple way. The two arguments were, one argument was what I termed a store of space-time, and the other argument I termed as a realization of space-time. Well, matter itself represents a store of space-time because you've got bound up energy in the nucleus. And then the electromagnetic fields in motion represent the realization of space-time, moving through space and time, see? So those two arguments are the two arguments that relate directly to, if you're talking about natural economics, see, there are two classical economics here, two factors of production according to classical economics. And those two factors of production would be land and labor. Well, land relates directly to matter. It's matter, and it represents the store of space-time. Labor translates directly and is analogous to electromagnetic fields, and it's the other factor of production. So the two natural factors of production are land and labor. The capital idea came in from the temple banking in the Babylonian era, and they started creating a need, a accumulation through donations and tithes and offerings, say, to give that money back out, but charge money for the time value of the money. So then they tied the interest back to the space-time continuum, say. But when you're talking about real natural economics here, and you're talking about only two dynamics, one land and one is labor. You combine these two things together. A man takes a seed. The seed is matter. He plants it in his land, which is matter. In doing that, he had to expend energy, which is a manifestation of the electromagnetic spaces, fields. The food that he has taken in is causing energy to be, you know, able to be used in movement by the human body. And that's a manifestation of the electromagnetic field systems. So then those two things together cause a crop to be nurtured and to be, you know, raised. Then he takes the crop and sells it into the economy, and boom, we've got natural economics. So capital itself is an invention, and it's especially a sorcery type of idea when you create a fractional banking system and these sets of books, and you're given a special monopoly of money creation or credit creation. And that's the real danger, see, of the Federal Reserve, is that it's not that it can't help to stabilize interest rates and all those other things. It does some things that probably are necessary in a highly sophisticated economy. But when it has a monopoly of money creation, then you're talking about money sorcery, and that's what they have become is sorcerers, see? And in sorcery, you're tricking people, see, into thinking about things in a certain way, see? And that's what magic is about. So when I talk about the modern banking system, I have to place upon that the terms money sorcery and money banking and unnatural, see. Now this is the real insight here, is that we have, and I believe that in England today, And I did some research before the Bilderberg group met over in England, in Watford. And bless Alex and his gang, Richard Reeves and all those people went over there. And McAdoo, and bless all of you for going over there and doing a good job. Skelton and Kaiser, Max Kaiser was there. A bunch of people. I wish I could have been there. Bless all of you for being there and standing up for what's right. There's 4,000 people out there for one event. So I started doing some research, and the name Jeremy Bentham popped up again. I had studied him years ago, and I knew his part in this Wax Museum of Horrors about interest. See, he and Adam Smith were contemporaries. See, and Adam Smith was talking about the markets, the invisible hand, and things like this. See. But there was a difference of opinion about interest rates and interest at that time. See, and when you look back now, today in England, because Jeremy Bentham, Panopticon, you got to look that word up. Panopticon, Panopticon, Panopticon. Look that up. Jeremy Bentham's brother, okay, had an idea about applying certain techniques of watching workers from one central location. He called that the panopticon, was because it's an observation type of word, see, in Latin. Well, Jeremy Bentham lifted that idea from his brother, Samuel Bentham, is his brother's name. And Jeremy started trying to apply this to prisons in England. So he, along with several architects, were designing a central location at the center of, a circular type of building where they could see in to all of the cells from that one location with a minimum of officers, say, of prison, you know, guards. And there was a series of blinds that they were going to set up between the watchers and the prisoners where the prisoner couldn't tell for sure, see, if they were being watched, see. Now, that's the kind of idea that Jeremy Bentham came up with. Brilliant ideas about how to imprison people and keep them there. My opinion now about people in prison is that a lot of them have been set up, and a lot of them are pretty good people. They shouldn't be there at all. The people in there that are in there for infractions of drug use shouldn't be there, period. They should be out here in some program, and AA or some kind of drug addiction program, trying to come off of that. So Jeremy Bentham today is a great. They're resurrecting the Jeremy Bentham. And this is what came out of my research on the Bilderberg group. So today in England, he's more popular now than when he was when he's living, you know? Oh, heaven forbid, you know. But anyway, so he was a great proponent of interest. Now, when you're talking about interest, you're talking about a fuel for the system. Recently, David Howard, an avowed communist Marxist, spoke in this country. He addressed a crowd, and in the title of his speech was "The End of Capitalism." And he went on to say that when you eliminate the debt, the end of capitalism is there. Well, David Howard, you're muchly mistaken. You end interest payment, you've ended capitalism. Now, he also, during this speech, spoke very well about the Chinese system of state capitalism. A year ago, last January, at Davos, David Rubenstein, representing the Carlyle Group as chairman, that's exactly what he said about the Chinese system of capitalism or capital, you know, state capitalism is what they're calling it. So we have two so-called authorities, one coming from a Marxist communist base of David Howard, and the other one is coming from a supposedly a big investment group chairman, David Rubenstein. They're saying the same thing. Hey, we're being set up. Our model is going to be like the Chinese model. That's where we're headed. Now, we've got to wake up here and try to realize we're running out of time. And what's happening is that the 9/11 was not an attack by foreign terrorists. The 9/11 is not being told the truth. The truth about it is not being disclosed to the American public. We must wake up to this fact or we're going to lose the country. And I said part of this the first hour tonight. The average American had been bamboozled. Through trauma-based programming, the event of 9/11 was so overwhelmingly traumatic that what it did was it created a post-traumatic stress disorder combined with a dissociative identity disorder. And those two things operating together with the fact that it was preposterous to even think that anyone on an inside basis or a black operation type basis could have pulled this off. So it had to be these foreign terrorists that did it. But there's problems there with this. When you look at it closely, the buildings alone could not have been felled by airplanes crashing into them. If you'll notice, right before both buildings fell, they blew out at the top. What was that about? There wasn't any plane around then. And then Building 7, World Trade Center 7, it was pulled by the commander, the fire commander and chief of police there. They made these decisions towards the end of the day. And when they said pull it, Silverstein said pull it. You know, I mean, we got him on tape saying that video, I mean, audio on that. And that meant bring it down. To bring it down, they had to have explosives planted inside World Trade Center Building 7. And that's what they had in there. It was a classical implosion, people. Go look at it. Don't let these magic wizards, sorcerers, take this country down with this big lie called the 9/11 attack from the foreign terrorist. Because if you go for this, you're going to lose the country. We're real close. They've taken 9/11, the lie, the myth, and they're using it to lock down and destroy what is good about this country. To awaken is to come out of that state. You've got to forgive yourself and others. They have us hating and resenting each other. The liberal Democrats hate the conservative Republicans. The left hates the right. The communists hate the capitalists. It goes on and on. There's all kinds of false left-right paradigms of, I think Alex coined one of these terms, the false left-right paradigm. Thank you, Alex. Anyway, we live and we learn. We've got to start looking at ourselves. You begin to know thyself when you can begin to forgive yourself and others. As long as you're continuing to hate and resent the other side, the other faction, the other party, the other political group, or whatever, they've got us divided, and you're also in a trap like a parrot. Years ago, I wrote a line that said, I think I have it on the website, The Secret Truth. The world is a jungle full of parrots. And what I meant by that was we've come out of the womb and we're immediately embraced by a loving mother and a family and a father. But also, what they're seeding into us is a worldly view, a world view of the world that they have been seeded into from their parents, and then their parents and their parents, the grandmothers, the great-grandmothers, and whatever. The ancestors did it to everybody. People don't know that they're actually furthering a false self a concept of false self versus the core real self. This is what is tragic in today's world, is that we're not aware of this, of self. We're thinking of self in a way that we think we know ourselves that well, and I know what I like, I know what I don't like, and so forth and so on, see. Well, that sounds real good until you begin to try to tread your way through a 9/11 truth trauma-based program that's been visited on the American public on a wide scale. You're not going to get there unless you can begin to forgive. If you don't start forgiving, then you're not going to be awake enough to see the 9/11 problem here that has been visited on America. Yes, you could see that World Trade Center Building 7 was somehow failed. And but you'll dismiss that it was imploded because that would be ridiculous. And you'll say, all those 9/11 truthers, they're a bunch of nutcases, see? So you'll just dismiss them. But those things buoyant your own false self and your own ego. And you begin to say, I'm the smart person. Those 9/11 truthers are dumb and they're fruitcakes and nutcases, see? But I'm smart and they're dumb. I'm okay. They're no good, see? These are the essence of the problem when we're dealing with these types of trauma-based programs. And 9/11 was a classic case of this. We are still suffering under this. And if the public will not awaken to a great enough degree, we're gonna lose the country. We've already lost it to a large scale already. Okay, so we get back to this space-time continuum and all this, and it's the nature-based economics versus a man-created system of economics called banking and finance and economic theory and physical things and monetary systems and monetary-driven and that's physical and you get all these different economists, and it's a hocus-pocus. See what I mean? Of economics. Not a one of them says anything about interest being a problem, period. Because they're all interest payers or givers. Or they're giving or receiving interest. In many cases, they're on the receiving end if they have any kind of wealth at all or any kind of a net worth, period. They're receiving interest because they like it, see? But interest itself is a problem. It is the fuel that fuels the beast, okay? And so your economist, whether it's von Mises or whatever, they're never going to say do away with interest, are they? We've got David Howard. He says just stop the debt. Yeah, that's yeah, David Howard. You're not even close. Anyways, those are some of my thoughts tonight. And these clashes are continuing over there. We do have a good article up on globalresearch.ca, okay? There's a foreign affairs expert up there, Michelle Chavadosky, and he heads up that site, and he's saying that this liberal, neoliberalism, neolibs are the ones running the operation in Egypt, and there's a, if you go in tonight or whenever you can to thesecrettruth.com and read that article, or go ahead and highlight it and transfer it into yourself, send it to someone, whatever. You'll see that there is a click-off written by an intellectual professor out of the London School of Economics and Political Science, by the way. That's the full name of that little school over there, right? London School of Economics and Political Science, okay? Well, anyway, if you go in there, the neoliberals, according to Michelle up here in Canada, have done a job on Egypt, okay? He's saying that the resulting deregulation of food prices, sweeping privatization, austerity measures have led to poverty and mass unemployment in Egypt. In turn, social programs collapsed. Egypt's economy and financial system were beginning to be destabilized. And this Christine Lagarde, she heads up the IMF. Those people are the worst people in the world. They only bring debt and put it on the shoulders of your poor, and then they just charge the hell out of you on interest. You know, but you have to have these loans to pay those imports, and they're going to give you the imports because they believe in the British model of open trade. See, and that's what the British were all about. They always push open trade because they're the ones exporting or importing into your country. They're exporting out of their country and importing into your country. That gets back to the British East India Company. But they're saying that Sisi, the defense minister over there, the head of the council, military council, was schooled here and all this. And anyway, go in there and read that. That's globalresearch.ca, okay? And that's a Canadian site. And that could really give you some insights. We're coming close to the end of this program. And I just want to thank everyone in our listening audience out there that we're going to be trying to bring you some of the finest interviews that we can put together. And we're not going to back off against 9/11 on this 9/11 truth. I'm sorry. It is the most important event that's ever occurred in United States history because it's so devilish and so diabolical, and it has already begun to destroy this nation in righteousness and goodness. That's how strongly I feel about it. Because I know how very, very dangerous it is to the goodness of this country and to the survival of this country. These mechanisms of security are to take out those people that are against that money system and those money cartels. They're not out here to take out terrorists. There's not that much terrorism out here. They're out here to identify the people that are in opposition to their money and banking cartel. And that's what it's about. And this is what's so sickening about it and very depressing in a way. I could fight this stuff now and not be depressed because I know who I am and what I care about and what I stand for. And what I stand for are things that they're certainly not into it all or never will stand for. And they stand for money and big egos and big everything to inflate themselves into thinking themselves as some great gods. Well, I'm not a god. I'll never be a god. I'll be just one little man in a great big world. But this one little man in a great big world really cares about this nation and this people. And that's why tonight I want to thank you again for listening. The POWs, we got to still bring the remnants home. Ask your senator and representatives about that. See what they say. Then you really find out where they're coming from also. And you might not like the answer you get from these people either. John McCain and John Kerry were no good. They did not bring our POWs home. And now they're even elevated to greater positions of power and glory and so forth. Well, anyway, I want to thank you again for listening and hang in there and start believing in yourself and forgiving yourself and letting go of that hates and resentments of others. And you're going to learn and grow a great deal. And this country can survive with you doing that. Thank you. Good night.